In the late 1960s, following years of US military involvement in Vietnam, an unprecedented rebellion against military authorities and the war began in the ranks themselves. Service people began avoiding combat, refusing orders, campaigning against the war, mutinying, and even killing their own officers in a movement which helped bring an end to the war. This is Working Class History.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Down by the riverside, gonna lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, study war no more.
In 1971, Marine Colonel Robert T. Heinel Jr. wrote a report which said, "By every conceivable indicator, our army that now remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers and non-commissioned officers, drug-ridden and dispirited where not near mutinous." In this two-part episode, we'll recover stories of the little-known resistance to the Vietnam War from within the ranks. We'll follow the journeys of Jerry Lemke, a US Army veteran, now author, sociologist, and professor, and Bart, who served in the Navy. To see how they ended up in Vietnam, we'll start at the beginning with Jerry, 8,000 miles away in Iowa.
I grew up in a small town in northwest Iowa called Hinton, which is near Sioux City. My parents were working class people. I went to the small town public high school there. Went to college at a small Lutheran school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Graduated in 1966 as a math major. And then I taught 8th grade, 9th grade math in Fort Dodge, Iowa between 1966 and 1968. During those years, I was deferred from the draft first for college, and then as a math teacher, had an occupational deferment. I really had no views of the war. I was really not political at all. This was 1966. Really, the anti-war movement was just, you know, beginning to stir. But in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I don't think I had even known about the war, much less the anti-war movement. And then teaching math in Fort Dodge, also the war kind of went past me. I really had no political views. I really had no knowledge about the war. I knew the draft was kind of hanging over my head, but frankly, I don't think I connected that with the war. The draft was one thing, and I'm sure I knew that there was conflict in a place called Vietnam, but I'm not sure that I really linked up the two. In 1968, after the Tet Offensive and the U.S. military called up yet more people for the war, then those occupational deferments for people like me were canceled. And the draft finally got me and others of my age cohort. And of course, then soon after I got drafted, then I was woke. I began to pay attention and I became, you know, pretty political pretty fast.
Bart was a young man from Illinois, around the same age as Jerry's students.
Military perspective, the peak of our troop levels were in 1968. And so if you go back then, I was probably a freshman in high school when I realized that the war was the reasons that we were there were not the reasons that the news media and President Johnson said we were there. And the more that I learned, the more I realized that we were there for all the wrong reasons. It was sort of like a combination of American imperialism, or also related to the anti-communist mindset. In summary, then, I knew the war was for the wrong moral and political reasons, and I was against it many years before I was eligible for the draft. The draft exempted you if you were in college. I was in college, but I sort of fooled around a little bit, and I got on in academic problems. So then I was eligible for the draft.
Due to his opposition to the war, Bart attempted to become a conscientious objector, which would have exempted him from serving in a combat role.
You would go before the local county. The way that they did that, they had the draft board set up. And if you, you know, had felt that you were a conscientious objector, then you could fill out a form. And then they reviewed your application, and you went before a board in a face-to-face, sort of like an interview, I guess you could say, to present your case verbally and face-to-face. And, you know, they would consider it, and then they came back, I don't know, it was a couple weeks later or something, and said that I'd been denied, but I had the right to appeal. So I appealed it, and you only have the right to one appeal. And so then on appeal, of course, I was turned down. I didn't expect it to succeed. This is such a long time ago, but I believe that what they said was it wasn't for a valid religious reason. Basically, the way they determined it was, well, you had to be a Quaker. Okay, if you were a Quaker, then they would give you consideration on religious grounds. I mean, I was raised a Presbyterian, and Presbyterians did not have any kind of a stated position about being against war in general, you know, whereas for somebody like the Quakers did. And so they basically said that I did not have a valid religious objection to the war. And so that's it. You know, you get one appeal, the appeal was denied. And so at that point in time, I knew that, well, since my draft number was number 4 out of 365, I was going to be drafted. So I joined the Navy to keep from being put into the Army and probably a grunt in the field.
A few years before Bart enlisted, Jerry's draft card got pulled.
I went to basic training at Fort Lewis, Washington in the summer of 1968. After basic training there, had options for the advanced training that we would have, what's called the Military Occupational Specialties, or MOS. And one day there were openings for Chaplain's Assistant School, and I raised my hand, as did about a dozen other people who were of my same age group, and a bunch of us then got selected to go to Chaplain's Assistant School, which was at Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn, New York, right at the end of the Verrazano Bridge in Brooklyn. Chaplains, of course, don't carry weapons. They're non-combatants under the Geneva Rules for International Warfare. But Chaplain's Assistants do carry weapons, sometimes said to be the arms bearer for the chaplains. So it wasn't a matter of being a conscientious objector or anything like that. It just sounded interesting. It sounded different.
In Brooklyn, Jerry received an additional training that went far beyond his chaplain assistant duties.
New York City was a very politicized environment at that time, late summer, early fall of 68. And that's really when I began to get politicized in a lot of ways, began to get educated about the war and a lot of other things. In Brooklyn, coming off post, we would be met by anti-war activists handing out leaflets to us and, of course, trying to dissuade us from continuing in the military. We were directed to a church nearby, if we wished to leave the military. We were told that we could be given sanctuary at that church. And then going on away from Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn, then we spent an awful lot of time in Manhattan. And the place was rife with anti-war activities. My very first anti-war demonstration that I ever witnessed was on the steps of St. Patrick Cathedral on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And I'm standing back watching and wondering what these people are doing and what they're protesting and why Fifth Avenue is blocked off. You know, coming to consciousness was thinking those people know something that I don't know. They know something I should know. I need to know what they know.
After finishing training, Jerry goes to Vietnam.
When I got to Vietnam, about New Year's Day, 1969, then got assigned to a chaplain in the artillery unit. It was just so different that it was anything beyond my imagination. You have to keep in mind, this is 1969, and Americans then, and certainly this guy who had grown up in a small town in Iowa, was even more unaware of the world than would be somebody today. Of course, we had television, but we didn't have, you know, so much of the global exposure that we have now. And my own educational background, small town high school and a kind of conservative Lutheran college at that time, I just knew nothing about Vietnam, very little about Asia. So just to see Vietnamese people, to see Vietnamese way of life, you know, to see rice paddies and grass-roofed huts. Days after I got there, I was just in awe of what I was seeing. And then the other big impression, of course, was the enormity of U.S. military presence itself. I had never been around military equipment. So to be around these big guns in the artillery, I had nothing like this in basic training. There was only the firing range and the bayonet exercise. So nothing, these big guns or, you know, the big trucks and stuff like this, tanks, armored personnel carriers clanking around. And then at night, Vietnam at night was a sound and light show. The flares going off, the guns going off, the occasional helicopter coming in. Choppers didn't fly too much at night, but the wop, 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 wop of those rotor blades coming in at night. I mean, you could just walk around. It was kind of surreal.
A bit later on down the line, in 1972, Bart begins his naval service.
When I first got to my ship, the USS Milwaukee, AOR-2, in order for you to talk to an officer, you had to put in a request. And that request had to go up the chain of command. Talk about cheeky, I guess. I put in a request. The enlisted officer that was directly, you know, in command of me in my division, and I said, I would like to talk to the captain. Of course, that was unusual. And they said, why did you want to talk to the captain? And I said, because I want out of the Navy. And the petty officer that at that time was sort of dumbstruck. You know, he couldn't believe, I guess, that I had the nerve to do that. But I did talk to him. My request was granted. And I talked to the captain of my ship, and he was a good man. He was a career Navy man, and you know, you'd have to be a captain of a ship. But anyway, his name was Shaughnessy, and he sat down with me, and he was real straightforward. And he goes, "Well, you know, you're young. Now maybe you'll change your mind." But I said, "Captain, I won't change my mind. I'm against this war. I never wanted to be here. I only enlisted because I was going to be drafted. And I'm telling you right now that I want a discharge, and I want to be out of the Navy because, you know, I'm against the Vietnam War." And the aftermath of that was that I was probably, you know, labeled a malcontent.
Bart quickly discovered he wasn't the only malcontent on board.
There were other people that were against the war. It wasn't just me on my ship. The ship that I was on was a ship that auxiliary underway replenishment supply ship. And what it did was it supplied carriers and their escort ships with supplies and fuel at sea underway. When we did that, there was always an exchange of information then somehow. I don't know, sometimes I think it was verbal, but other times then they were able to pass written kinds of information. And I don't know if you know this, but some of the ship published their own anti-war material. And the carriers seemed to do that more than the other ships, probably because a carrier is so big and, you know, you could put together a press and actually, you know, compose and print like newsletters or something like that. So in those situations, then somehow then we had the opportunity to pass unofficial communications.
¶¶ Back in early 1969, Jerry is assisting a chaplain in an artillery unit.
The chaplain and I, our day-to-day role was to move around from firebase to firebase, these very small gun placement sites around the Central Highlands, mountaintops, hillsides, moving around by helicopter, oftentimes, or by road, by jeep, in which case I was the driver. So I was out and about more than the great majority of guys who were in Vietnam who got siloed into these small camp areas and really never saw much of Vietnam or much of other military operations other than their own unit. I was in Vietnamese hospitals, Vietnamese churches, schools, a leprosarium, orphanages, as well as in U.S. military hospitals. And with the chaplain, I would occasionally get to sit in on briefings for the day. So it was, gosh, it was like a fly on the wall experience.
The more people Jerry met, the more he observed a growing discontent.
A lot of what I think is construed as anti-war within the military at that time was actually anti-military. I think a lot of the earliest resistance was resistance to military authority. Then things matured from there into of the anti-war stuff per se. And even, you know, things like fragging, say, in Vietnam. Fragging was the practice of the GIs and other lower-ranking military people attacking officers. The term fragging comes from fragmentation grenades, the basic hand grenade. When it explodes, it fragments, and it sends pieces of metal, shrapnel, flying in all directions. And so a common form of attack against officers became throwing a hand grenade in the wrong direction so that it landed with your own officers, or maybe at night planting a hand grenade on a walk path that would be triggered then by a tripwire, and it would go off killing or injuring officers. The term kind of became used more broadly as any kind of serious physical forms of resistance.
Fragging wasn't just a couple of isolated incidents. The U.S. Army investigated 800 fragging incidents in Vietnam. If soldiers had difficulty fragging a particular officer, they'd often do whip rounds to raise a bounty for anyone who killed them. One underground GI newspaper publicly offered a $10,000 reward to anyone who killed an unpopular Lieutenant Colonel, Weldon Honeycutt, who'd ordered an attack on Hill 937 which left 500 US troops killed or injured. There were several attempts on him, but he'd managed to survive until the end of his tour.
A lot of that was simply because of dislike of officers and non-commissioned officers, you know, higher-ranking sergeants, that sort of thing. And that's what I witnessed. But even what I just witnessed was pretty low-level kind of stuff. What I would describe really as counter-harassment, whereas officers we viewed as harassing us, we began to do things like plant trip flares on walkways where we knew officers would be passing that night on their way to their hooches to scare them and to send a signal, you know, that flare could have been a hand grenade and you could have tripped a hand grenade. One night at my base camp, one of the officers' jeeps went up in flames. And I had nothing to do with that, but I knew who did, and I knew why they did it. Now, there was no officer in the Jeep, but that's pretty serious. You could say a shot across the bow, and a pretty serious way of saying, back off, or, you know, or the next one could be more serious. So by mid-1969, there was a lot of that I knew about and that I saw. And then a lot of the still more minor stuff, the wearing of peace symbols and so forth. And some of that was just to get under the skin of officers.
Back on ship, Bart was learning more about anti-war activities elsewhere in the fleet.
There were other people that were against the war. It wasn't just me on my ship. And so we used to call it scuttlebutt. Scuttlebutt is a term for gossip. And the scuttlebutt would be, okay, there's an anti-war contingent upon this ship. And we passed information back and forth. When the Constellation came out of San Francisco back into the combat line, you know, we supplied the Constellation at sea, and the rumors were rampant as far as what was going on the Constellation. There were all kinds of rumors. Some of them were so fantastic, some of us didn't believe them. I didn't believe that there were that kind of racial issues on the Constellation, or that they were the kind of anti-war issues on the Constellation, but it turned out to be true.
On the USS Constellation, the first mass mutiny ever in the US Navy broke out, organized by African-American sailors in protest at endemic race discrimination. Black sailors also rebelled on the Kitty Hawk aircraft carrier. And two merchant seamen on the USS Columbia Eagle, carrying 10,000 tons of napalm, mutinied and took control of the ship, sailing it to Cambodia.
It was widespread on other ships. I'll give you an example. I wasn't aware of this until later on. The Constellation had big racial issues. But in addition to that, they had a commissioned officer who was anti-war. And he actually got the crew together, and he got over 1,000 signatures telling the captain that they should have Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland's Fuck the Army review on Constellation. You can imagine how that went over. So that's just one example, but there were other ones. The biggest contingents were on the aircraft carriers, that I'm sure of. Some people said it was save our ships. Some people said it was sabotage our ships. Some people said it was stop our ships. But the first thing that I was aware of was that, you know, that was an anti-war movement that was gaining strength in the Navy after I got on the ship. There actually was sabotage on several of the aircraft carriers, and I think some of the other ships as well. At one time, I think there were like 4 aircraft carriers that were unable to go out to sea because either of crew morale or even quasi-mutiny situations, or they had been sabotaged and they were unable to go out to sea. One time, I think there were like 4 carriers. I found this out later on talking to other veterans. We had a fellow on our ship that went, we never got the real story about it, but basically he threatened to blow up the ship. He had access to a munitions locker on the ship. He was never fully identified, but the rumor was that this was also, you know, he was anti-war, and that was the reason for it. They called us to quarters about 2 a.m. at night, and they had us all stand in a line and put out our hands, and they ran an ultraviolet light over our hands. And whoever had gotten into this munitions locker, then there was like a die, like you would, like in a bank robbery that, you know, they would use now. Only it was something that would only show up on ultraviolet light exposure, and I didn't see who the guy was, but I saw him being taken off the ship next day in a straitjacket, and we never heard from him again.
Jerry describes what sort of methods soldiers used to resist.
There was a lot of, I guess what you call work slowdown or working by rule. I know that's a part of working class culture. You know, there's a book called The Wars We Took to Vietnam, and the author is Milton Bates. And one of those wars is the class war, he says. Labor conflict, you know, class conflict that played out on the shop floor back home, transported to Vietnam, and it played out in Vietnam as conflict between draftees and other low-ranking service people, and the brass, and the officers. And so a lot of it was resistance to military authority. the key word there being authority, and whether it was military authority or just authority, I think, particularly after reading Milton Bates's book on this, that a lot of it was simply class conflict by U.S. military law. You don't have to follow illegal orders. Well, in a place like Vietnam, there's an awful lot of discretion. And if you're told to do something, there is a lot of room for interpretation, whether that is a legal order or not. And so you could always refuse that order and then wait for further adjudication. And that itself then is a way of slowing things down. You don't do what you're told to do, and then you wait for the propriety of that to be determined. And so it would impede, it would slow down, you know, what the mission that was to be accomplished. Inspections, oftentimes, the higher officers in a unit would try to pass the inspection of their unit by getting their underlings to falsify records. That's one thing that I witnessed. People working in the headquarters, you know, were asked to basically hide records that were not kept up to date. Well, these guys came to me, the chaplain's assistant, and they said, "We're being asked to do this. You know, what should we do?" Well, I happen to know that at the end of this inspection, when the inspecting general, before he left our camp, he would have a kind of an open house or a time for anybody to raise grievances that they wanted to. These are very pro forma kinds of things. I mean, no private is going to walk up to a general and say, "Sir, I would like to report that Major so-and-so told me to do this, and that's illegal." Well, when this happened, these guys came to me. I said, "Look," I said, "there is going to be this opportunity." And by golly, that toward the end of that day, when the general was in our unit and his other duties were over and he was about to leave to go back to his headquarters, I had guys line up to tell him what had gone down on the days just preceding this inspection. And the officers of our unit were just steamed. They were just livid. They just stood by in a little cluster just watching this line of guys. It was a short line. I don't want to exaggerate, but these guys standing waiting for their turn to talk to the general and tell the general what they had been told to do. Literally, documents had been hidden behind sandbags, documents that our officers did not want the inspecting general to see. There's one instance. Now, I not only had the right to do what I did, but it was one of my duties for the day was to make sure everybody knows that if they want to talk to the inspecting general, that'll be at 3:00 this afternoon, and it will be, you know, over here under this tree, and so on and so forth. So that's what I did. And I told them that they have a right to do this. So, you see, that's a kind of working to rule that kind of threw the wrench into the way the command was operating. Things like that occurred out in the field, too, where people would refuse to do things that they knew they didn't have to do, you know, or refuse to exercise their own discretion on an operation and do something that they were not explicitly ordered that they would have to do. You know, working to rule. And gosh, anybody who's been on any kind of military operation would know that if everybody only worked to rule, the operation would never get completed. Just like a construction work job would never get completed, right, if the workers only did what they were explicitly told what to do. Then that class conflict got politicized by the war itself, politicized as anti-war, as people like me began to learn more about the war. You know, I don't think I heard the words colonization or imperialism until I got to Vietnam. And I heard those words then from other GIs, people who knew more than I knew. And then the pieces began to fall into place. My first R&R, I had two R&Rs from Vietnam. The first one was in Sydney, Australia. And there in Sydney, I think probably the first morning out of the hotel, I was met a young woman who asked me if I wanted to go to a coffee house. And I said, sure, not knowing it would be an anti-war coffee house. That wasn't on my mind, but it was.
I look for peace in the flower. I feel peace with everyone.
And there I was given a handful of anti-war literature, given a peace symbol, a large, very large necklace peace medallion, which I still have. It's hanging on my wall. I wish I could show it to you right now. I went back to Vietnam, you know, carrying the literature I'd been given and wearing that medallion, which got me into a lot of trouble in Vietnam. The military authorities not liking that so much. But by that time, this was middle of 1969, lots of guys were wearing anti-war paraphernalia. People were etching peace symbols onto their helmets and so on and so forth. So it was becoming quite prominent then in Vietnam in 1969. Probably that was kind of the beginning of that prominence of GI anti-war activity in Vietnam.
From late 1969, the GI resistance movement continued to grow. Large numbers of troops joined a national moratorium, a day of protest in the US on the 15th of October 1969, by refusing to go out on missions. Soldiers sent to search and destroy instead chose to search and avoid enemy combatants. Some anti-war activities became more overt, as GIs published underground newspapers and broadcast via pirate radio. One unit refused orders to advance while being filmed by TV news. And in 1971, the men of Bravo Company, who were acting covertly on the Cambodian border, refused an order to leave their base, then signed a petition against the operation. They were pulled out and replaced by Delta Company, who then refused to go out as well, which forced the army to pull them out, as well as a whole artillery company alongside it. Despite all this, the war continued, as did Bart's deployment.
I was on the ship in the Gulf of Tonkin on Yankee Station. We bombed North Vietnam on a constant basis from December of 1972 till the peace accords were signed, I think, in the middle of January of 1973. And I mean the heaviest bombing of the war, combined the Navy and the Air Force. 24 hours a day saturation bombing. And so after the truce was signed and we got back to the U.S., I won't call it AWOL, they used to call it unauthorized absence. I had a petty officer that knew about, you know, about my situation. The only way I can say it is he would give me all these bullshit details and assignments, you know, where I would expose myself to nasty working conditions or, you know, unreasonable orders that were just meant to make me obey, no matter how unreasonable the order was. Finally, I said, you know, no, I'm not going to obey that order, and I went to captain's mast as a result of it. I know basically I went to what was called captain's mast three times. Yeah. Two times for the unauthorized absences and one time for that incident. So between those three incidents, then I was, you know, I got knocked down from an E3 to E1. So it took me, I don't know, several months of disobedience. After the truce was signed, there was a force-wide reduction, not just in the Navy, but in the Army and, you know, all the armed forces. There was a huge reduction in force. And so then, because of everything combined, the captain offered me a discharge. And it was a general discharge under honorable conditions, which is now an honorable discharge because they found out that, that was not a, a legal discharge and they had no choice but to make it an honorable discharge. So I guess what I'm trying to say in summary is that I sort of had to work to get that discharge, but I made it very plain to the captain of my ship that, that I did not believe in the Vietnam War and I wanted to get out of the Navy. I was discharged in November of 1973.
Like Bart, over 350,000 other service personnel went AWOL during the conflict. From the kind of harassment and demotions that Bart experienced, to court-martials, jail sentences, and even threats of execution. Soldiers and sailors were given long prison sentences for things like refusing to ship out, refusing to help induct trainees, or even just for talking to Marines against the war. One Navy nurse was court-martialed for marching on a peace demonstration in her uniform and for dropping anti-war leaflets on Navy bases from a plane. Military prisons everywhere were overcrowded and bursting with detainees. In the Presidio stockade in San Francisco, 27 soldiers launched a sit-down protest against the killing of an inmate, linking arms and singing, "We Shall Overcome." They were court-martialed and threatened with the death penalty, eventually being jailed for up to 16 years each until a mass campaign got them released after just 18 months. The Long Binh jail in Vietnam, designed for 400 prisoners, held 719 by mid-1968, 90% of whom were black. On the 29th of August that year, black and white prisoners revolted, beating their guards, killing one, destroying the prison, and attacking the colonel who came to calm them down. Well, that's it for part one. In part two, we'll be speaking more with Jerry about Vietnam Veterans Against the War and the legacy of the movement and why it's so little known today. We've got links to more information and further reading in the show notes, including where to get Jerry's books, which include The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, CNN's Tailwind Tale, Inside Vietnam's Last Great Myth, Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal, and PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-America Empire, related to Vietnam, which he describes as...
I've written four books on what I call post-Vietnam War American culture, studies of how the war continues to be processed through popular culture, through folklore, myth, legends, Hollywood film, of course.
Part two will be online for our Patreon supporters on the 6th of August. So you can support us and listen to it, as well as other exclusive content, at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. We've also got a Patreon-exclusive episode at the moment on the class war at home, the strike wave which swept the US during the war. Part two will be available for everyone else next week. We've also produced a range of merchandise commemorating the GI Resistance, which is in our online store. Check it out at workingclasshistory.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Stephanie Heidel for editing this episode. And catch you next time.
I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.